From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the story of the Serbian resistance movement of students and young people that helped bring down Slobodan Milosevic. We talk with Serge Popovic, co-founder of the group Otpor, which means resistance in Serbian. This nonviolent group used humor and street theater to ridicule and confound officials. Popovic is now a member of the Serbian parliament. He's one of the people interviewed in a new PBS documentary about Otpor. Also, we talk with former firefighter Dennis Smith about his new book, Report from Ground Zero, the story of the rescue efforts at the World Trade Center. And pop critic Ken Tucker reviews Wish You Were Here, Love Songs for New York, an anthology of songs recorded in reaction to the attacks of September 11th. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate has approved a campaign finance reform bill that would ban the unregulated donations to political parties known as soft money. The measure, which passed on a vote of 60 to 40, now goes to President Bush, who's expected to sign it. In addition to eliminating soft money, the McCain-Feingold bill would limit the amount of money that can be given to state and local political parties, and it would restrict outside groups from paying for political commercials shortly before elections. Opponents of the plan said they'd challenge it in court. More evidence today that U.S. troops still face dangers in Afghanistan. U.S. commanders say an American base there came under attack last night from suspected al-Qaeda or Taliban fighters. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
The fighting took place at a military checkpoint near the Khost airport in eastern Afghanistan. Unknown gunmen attacked with machine guns, rocket-propelled grenades, and mortars. One American soldier was shot in the arm during the hour-long battle. Three allied Afghan fighters are said to have been killed. At the Pentagon, Air Force Brigadier General John Rosa said the enemy fire seemed to be meant to harass the U.S. troops.
I would expect to see more of this. We knew as we break these folks down into pockets, we could expect this.
The commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, Army Major General Franklin Hagenbeck, told reporters there that al-Qaeda operatives right now are going to great lengths to try to regroup or regenerate. They're a very adaptable enemy, he said. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
House Republicans have brought what they call a wartime budget to the floor for a vote this evening. Democrats charge the $2.1 trillion spending plan brings back federal deficit spending. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
The budget plan for next year's federal spending gives an extra $48 billion to the Pentagon, a 13% increase, but funding for non-defense programs rises less than inflation. Democrats say last year's big tax cut helped push the proposed budget into the red, but they offered no alternative plan. Some Republicans who want more defense spending also object to the budget. Kurt Weldon of Pennsylvania says there are no assurances that a $10 billion reserve fund will be spent on defense.
I can't in good conscience vote for this budget. President Bush is my president. I support him. It pains me unbelievably to stand up here and have to say what I'm saying.
Meanwhile, it's looking increasingly unlikely that the House will be able to reconcile its budget plan with one still being worked out in the Democratic-controlled Senate. David Wellner, NPR News, The Capitol.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 133 points or 1.2% to close at 10,501 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 48 points, or 2.5%. It closed at 1,832. The S&P 500 lost 18 points. This is NPR News. The prosecution in the bribery and corruption trial of Ohio Congressman James Traficant wrapped up its case today. The congressman, who's representing himself, is expected to call his first witness tomorrow. Kevin Niedermeyer reports for member station WKSU.
After 55 government witnesses have taken the stand, James Traficant is now ready to put on his defense. Though he's not a lawyer, the congressman is acting as his own attorney, fighting 10 charges. During the nearly 6 weeks of testimony so far, prosecution witnesses ranged from former Traficant staffers alleging he demanded kickbacks from their salaries to businessmen who say he accepted gifts for government help. The prosecution's last witness, an IRS investigator, told the jury Traficant failed to report nearly $80,000 in gifts on his 1998 and 99 tax returns. The congressman says the government never presented physical evidence he took any money as kickbacks or for political favors. Traficant faces a possible 60 years in prison. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Niedermeyer in Cleveland.
Jurors report that they've reached verdicts in four of the five charges against a San Francisco couple whose dog mauled a neighbor to death. The jurors, who've been deliberating all day at a Los Angeles courthouse, sent word to the judge that they want to adjourn and consider the remaining count tomorrow. Marjorie Knoller is charged with second-degree murder and other charges in the death of Diane Whipple. Her husband, Robert Noel, faces lesser charges because he wasn't present during the killing. The couple, both lawyers, say they had no warning that their dogs were dangerous. Witnesses for the prosecution said the dogs acted aggressively on many occasions. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novozoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As the Serbian president Slobodan Milosevic stands trial in The Hague for crimes against humanity, a new PBS documentary tells the story of the nonviolent movement that helped overthrow him. Bringing Down a Dictator will premiere on many PBS stations March 31st. It focuses on the group Otpor, which means resistance in Serbian. It was formed by a small group of college students in 1998. My guest, Serge Popovic, was a founding member. He was one of the group's strategists, and he wrote the group's training manuals. After the overthrow of Milosevic, Popovic was elected to the parliament. He also serves now as environmental affairs advisor to the Serbian prime minister. Otpor was a nonviolent movement of young people. It used rock music to help draw people out. Instead of force, Otpor often used street theater and humor to ridicule Milosevic and strip away some of his power by making him look foolish. For instance, during an eclipse, Otpor took to the streets with a long telescope its members had constructed. When you looked through it, you saw that Milosevic was the butt of the joke.
We organized a small action, inviting the newspapers and photographers and cameras and people in Belgrade. So we made a four meters long telescope on which end there was a kind of made comet. A head of comet was, of course, the head of Slobodan Milosevic, and tail was melting. So one was looking through that telescope the day of the eclipse. Well, of course, everybody was speaking of the eclipse, you know how it was, could see the Slobodan Milosevic falling. And that was the very sympathetic message, and the papers were full of pictures of that telescope for days. And it was cheap, it was very, very simple to organize, and it was very, very strong message. Because, you know, in Serbia, as well as anywhere in the world, you have that superstitious. So if you're speaking on the eclipse and there is a sign, and we wanted our action to be a sign, a lot of very primitive people generally supporting Milosevic will start thinking, there must be some kind of, you know, craftsmanship inside that. And that was a very good message. Another one was on Milosevic's birthday. Otpor prepared a cake consisted of parts of Serbia and Yugoslavia, which Milosevic has lost in wars. So it was the whole ex-Yugoslavia on the cake, but you have the one slice for Slovenia, another slice for Croatia, third slice for, I don't know, Bosnia and Herzegovina, and last slice for Kosovo. And there was a very small part of the cake still intact in the middle, on which it was written Dedinje, which is the part of town, Belgrade, the richest part of town where Milosevic's family lived. It was on cover page of all papers, and it was like you were joking with a guy who is so dangerous, who is the Balkanian butcher number one. And that gave people a hope that there are the kids in its country who can joke with Milosevic. To leave them to joke with you, you will have all cover pages and whole nation will laugh to you. To arrest them, which means that you're giving them the credits to being very big threat to your regime. And it is the in policy of nonviolent struggle to put your enemies in no winning scenario.
It seems that Otpor was primarily a movement of younger people. I know you tried to get everybody in it, but I think, correct me if I'm wrong, that most of the people were probably in their teens and their 20s, maybe their early 30s.
General average age of the movement was 21.
Yeah. So I know, like in the United States, for instance, in the 60s and 70s, when there was a big youth-oriented anti-war movement, that there was often generational differences. The parents were angry with the children for protesting. Families were kind of breaking apart over political differences. Was anything similar happening in Serbia when so many of the young people were going into the streets and protesting Milosevic?
Well, the parents were the very important target group of Otpor, because those kids were, you know, just shaming their parents for sitting and doing nothing. And this is the very strong message to the parents, because even those who were supporting Milosevic were first parents and then Milosevic supporters.
So even parents who supported Milosevic, you think eventually were so worried about their children and how Milosevic was targeting them that they turned against Milosevic?
Nobody likes to see the children or the friends of his children arrested.
So every time Milosevic arrested a student, you think two more parents started to hate Milosevic?
Two more students and three more parents.
Right. Now, you wrote a lot of the tactics for the group, and you wrote some of the training literature. What are other young people's movements, student movements, that inspired you and things that you took as kind of lessons?
Not long time ago, I was watching that Force More Powerful movie and saw how the Afro-American activists are preparing each other to be arrested. And it was almost the same thing we were doing with our kids. Almost the same thing. Two different continents, two different struggles, but completely same model. And you know what is interesting about that? They were both successful.
Mm-hmm. Did Tiananmen Square scare you? Because here you have this like student movement that for the first few days, it looks great. I mean, it's peaceful. Young people are out there. They're protesting, but it's almost like a carnival. It's a happy occasion. And then the police move in, and students are butchered. And that unleashes a terrible crackdown that lasts for years. Were you afraid of a reaction like that?
No. Tiananmen Square is a great example of very big trap, usually coming to the successful movements. The first lesson is that you must have the winning record. Your complete strategy must rely on a policy of small victories. You know, it is one step and then proclaim the victory and then another step, because success born success, and people will follow successful movements. The great experience on tragedy on Tiananmen Square was that students had some demands in China, and they were close to win those demands, and government was ready to step back and to accept their demands, but then their leaders were, you know, drunk of their success, and they were like, we will stay for a little bit longer and ask for a little bit more. And then the military forces from Manchuria were brought, and they were smashed to hell. And it's still non-democracy in China. This is the very important lesson for all nonviolent movements. And that's the sentence: you must know when and how to proclaim the victory.
Give me an example of a victory that you proclaimed. You said, hey, we won this one, and then you move on to the next event.
Absolutely. We did a very big event at January the 13th, which is the Orthodox New Year. And we invited maybe 20, 30,000 people in Republic Square on Belgrade for a New Year's celebration. And that was probably the most risky action, because it is the habit in Serbia to wait for that important date on the street. And those people came there searching for fun. And of course, at midnight, there was, you know, a concert announced to start, but we put the drummers, because the Otpor relied a lot on the rock music, on the stage. We were drumming for maybe 15 minutes so people can feel the New Year is coming, and then we break the thing. And through the very big screen, we were absolutely, you know, people were absolutely shocked and frozen, shown the dozens of faces of those people who were killed in Milosevic's war. And then we have broken the celebration and say, okay, this was it. This is the year with capital T. This year, the life must finally win in Serbia. So go home now. No reason to celebrate anything right now. And let's see each other next year on the same place, so we can have the reason to celebrate things. And do you know what is interesting? It happened. It was the January the 13th of the year 2000, the year year in which life finally won in Serbia. And 1 year after that, it was a very big celebration on the Republic Square. But that was typical risky action in which we break the celebration, send the people home, make the national story on which message was very clear. No reason to celebrate anything was one message, and he will be done in a year, meaning on Milosevic, on another. That was typical action. Okay, we could stick those. In Serbian history, there is no politician who will send 30,000 people home. In each country, probably in the United States of the America, every politician will try to speak to them for hours while they're listening. We are probably the first who are using sending people home as a very strong message.
Okay, so that New Year celebration, your message was, this is the year, it's his last year. And in fact, it was his last year. In 2000, he lost the election on September 24th to Koštunica. But Milosevic refused to leave office. And in response, hundreds of thousands of Serbs converged on Belgrade and eventually occupied the federal parliament building until he conceded. Let's go back to the beginning of that. Let's go back to September 24th, when Milosevic refused to concede the election, even though it was clear that he lost. What did the leadership of Otput decide to do?
Actually, it was all the part of the plan. The key campaign in removing Milosevic wasn't the positive campaign for the Koštunica or the very important get-out-to-vote campaign, which brought all younger people who are usually voting abstinence to the ballot boxes. The key campaign was Otpor negative campaign named Gotovje, which actually means he's finished, thinking on Milosevic. Practically at the beginning of August, when the elections were called, we were preparing people for a big psychological victory. Each dictator is finished once the majority of the people know it's finished. So losing the elections was just a good proof to the people that Milosevic has the minority in the country. And it was really difficult to persuade them that he will still survive. So his last desperate moves were just a part of the scenario we prepared. Everything we should do was wait for him to proclaim the elections non-valid and then to proclaim the general strike. And all the people responded to that call.
So you proclaimed a general strike and everybody responded. What happened?
Actually, everybody proclaimed a general strike. Right. Syndicates, party leaders, Koštunica, Otpor, school workers, everybody proclaimed a general strike. It was just a very logical movement. Well, sincerely speaking, I don't know who firstly proclaimed that. It was the logical explanation, a logical response. We knew it will happen.
And where were you during those days of the general strike?
Training people let's explain it this way. The Otpor deal with the opposition leaders was that there must be the day in which people from all Serbia will come to Belgrade. And Otpor's job was to do that, rising up the universities in Belgrade, keep students on streets for at least 7 or 8 hours a day. It was terrible. It was like between 20 and 30 kilometer marches around Belgrade and around Belgrade and around Belgrade and through the center of Belgrade and blocking the roads. So the Belgrade energized enough to accept that energy coming from another cities at the October the 5th. So actually, I was dealing with the organization of those 5 or 6 days of very strong students' protests in Belgrade.
My guest is Serdjo Popović, a co-founder of the Serbian resistance group Otpor, which helped bring down Slobodan Milosevic. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Serdjo Popović, one of the founders of the Serbian resistance group Otpor, which is profiled in an upcoming PBS documentary called Bringing Down a Dictator. Would you describe what it was like in the streets on those days of the general strike, in the days between the time that Milosevic refused to concede the election and the time that he actually was thrown out of office?
It was like a small miracle. You know, all Belgrade stopped and public transportation was parked all around the streets. And people were parking cars wherever they are because the general aim was to block the traffic. And traffic was smashed. And you could walk. I was walking with my girlfriend, taking her for a hand. And for example, if I would like to block the street, just pushing the container on the street, there would be a 15 people helping me from a thin air. And that was like, you know, you could feel in the atmosphere that nothing is the same and that nothing will come back to normal before Milosevic leave. And that was very strong message to him. That was very strong message to the police also, because we developed the complete tactics towards the police, trying to avoid the physical conflict with them and telling them that there are absolutely no difference between the victims in the blue jeans, which were Otpor guys, and victims in the blue uniforms, which were the police guys, and that we are all the victims in the system. And in one moment, when people from the police recognized that it is not anymore opposition and Otpor against Milosevic, against the regime, but it was the people against Milosevic, they didn't want to be losers together with Milosevic. And of course, they could avoid shooting in the crowd because some of their own children were there.
Could you feel, was there like a moment when things shifted, when you realized that the police were going to be on your side and instead of shooting at you, they'd be supporting you?
Actually, it was very clear at the very beginning of the October the 5th, because during the day, columns were coming, columns of vehicles all through the Serbia. And it was very small resistance of the police. They built up the barricades all around the Belgrade. They had strict orders to stop those people going to Belgrade, which was practically ridiculous because there is no police force which can stop the column 40 kilometers long. And as day was coming, it was practically very clear that police will build the barricades but not defend them. And what happened in front of the federal parliament, because of course we were all surveilling the police as well as they were surveilling us, is that the people in the federal parliament and a building of national television were given strict orders to shoot to the crowd, but it never happens. They never shoot to the crowd.
At what point did you know, this is it, it's over, we've won?
Well, I know far before the October the 5th, but generally October the 5th at 5 p.m. when a special police squad surrendered to the people running around with Otpor and Serbian flags through the city, it was pretty obvious.
And what did you do then?
Oh, me, myself, I misused my position of a leader of the march and took the car in which there was a strong loudspeaker, put a petrol inside the aggregate which was moving the loudspeaker, and start the long march from Otpor's office in Knez Mihailova towards the Slavia Square in Belgrade, producing impossible techno noise which attracted between 20 and 30,000 people to one of the biggest parties I've ever been.
And what was the first day like after Milosevic stepped down? How did
sunny, nice, with all the people camping around the Belgrade. It was the tremendous experience for me because all of my life changed that day. The sun was rising, federal parliament was black and smoked, and there were very big crowd of very happy people around, still with flags, still on streets, because we had the strict orders to stay on streets 2 or 3 days after the October the 5th because of the possibility of, you know, parts of the army react or whatever, and we should protect that with our own bodies. And that day I gave the promise to myself that this part of my life is over and that maybe I will do some politics or something else for the rest of my life, but it will never influence and play with my life as it was before the October the 5th. And I still stick to that promise.
Well, in fact, you are in politics now. You ran for the parliament in Serbia. You won. You're in parliament. You're an environmental activist within parliament. In a way,
Yes, but it is not influencing my life anymore. Right. I finally had some time, you know, for friends, for my girl,
right,
for my parents,
right.
For fishing, for all those things that were the sacrifice to the revolution in 2 years of Otpor and even before during the Democratic Party's period.
Having seen what politics was like and how corrupt it was under Milosevic, I would have thought you might have hated politics so much you wouldn't have wanted to enter it. Why did you want to run for office?
Actually, I was the highly ranked functionary of Democratic Party even before Otpor. In 1996, I was elected as the youngest member of Belgrade City Parliament, and politics was my decision from 1993. One of my promises and promises of my friends in Otpor was that it is not only the changing the regime we are wanting, but the changing of system. And system is so old-fashioned, so bureaucracy, so corrupted, that there are a lot of years invested in its reconstruction. And each of us decided to change it in our own way. My old friends, who are still running for Otpor campaigns, they decided to change the system from the outside. And some of us, like Ivan Andrić and me and others who are in the parliament, we decided to change it from the inside. And actually, I'm just continuing my mission.
Have you been watching the Milosevic war crimes trial?
Rarely. I get enough of Milosevic.
Why aren't you watching it more? You fought so hard to get rid of him. Here he is on trial now in The Hague. Why aren't you watching it?
Unfortunately, I consider Hague very expensive circus, which is giving Milosevic credit to once again get back to the political scene and prove the fact he was basing his tragical national policy on, that there is an international community against Serbs. They're even denying the existence of Kosovo Liberation Army. So watched from the angle of people in Serbia, Milosevic is getting credits for that accusation. And I'm very, very sad that is happening and that may strengthen the retrograde powers in our society.
Have you been in the position yet where there have been any protests against the way you've used your power in parliament?
Actually, yes. And there is a big difference because we are communicating with our political opponents and people who do not agree with our policy. And this is absolutely new tradition in Serbia. You know, we have Otpor and NGO groups monitoring the parliament. Actually, the president of the parliament invited all those who would like to be there. And it is the beginning of good democratic change in my country, in which, of course, civilian control over state organs is the basic stone for democracy.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Sergio Popovic is one of the people featured in the PBS documentary Bringing Down a Dictator, which premieres on many PBS stations March 31st. He's now a member of the Serbian parliament. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And also by Avalon Travel Publishing, publisher of Moon Handbook's travel guides to Asia, the Pacific, and the Americas, on the web at moon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, retired New York City firefighter Dennis Smith. His new book, Report from Ground Zero, includes interviews with police and firefighters who were at the World Trade Center as the towers collapsed. And Ken Tucker reviews a new collection of love songs for New York, recorded in response to September 11th. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dennis Smith, is a retired New York City firefighter who's now an honorary assistant chief of department. He's also the author of the bestseller Report from Engine Company 82. On September 11th, after the second tower of the World Trade Center was attacked, he walked to his neighborhood firehouse in Manhattan and went with the firefighters to Ground Zero. He arrived just after the second tower collapsed. He kept returning to Ground Zero to work in the bucket brigade that was clearing the debris searching for human remains. Now Smith has a new book called Report from Ground Zero that includes interviews with many police and firefighters who were in or nearby the towers at the time of their collapse. I asked him what he was able to do when he arrived after both towers had collapsed.
Well, there wasn't really much to do. There was people walking over the piles, yelling out names and that kind of thing, trying to find any survivors. You know, it's in the experience of the fire department that in a major collapse like this that you will find survivors, because the way buildings collapse, generally speaking, there are a great many voids that are left in the building. You know, for instance, when a wall gets cantilevered over, and there is a big spaces where human beings will fall or get trapped or whatever, but they would still be alive. And this is common in earthquakes, for instance. But here, you know, there were 15, 16 survivors that survived the collapse itself. And there were 14 in the North Tower and 2 in the South Tower. And when I got there, the one in the South Tower had been rescued and the other one was about to be rescued. And the 12 that were trapped in the North Tower were still trapped. Now, hardly anyone knew they were there, of course. And then finally, when they made radio contact, and they made radio contact in a very interesting way, Billy Butler called his wife way upstate New York, and he told her, well, look, stop crying, because you have to do something, you know, call the firehouse, have somebody in the firehouse go over to the site and tell them that we're here and we're alive and that we're on between the second and the fifth floor of the North Tower. And, of course, the second and the fifth floor, what at one time was the second and fifth floor, was no longer that. It was just, you know, another sort of mound in a pile of rubble. And the firefighters finally found them about 4 hours later. And they were, essentially, they were taken out and they came out of their own accord. There were a couple who were pulled out from, two men from Engine 39 who were pulled out from the first floor. And they were pulled up a height of about 30 feet.
Did you interview the man who had phoned his wife while he was trapped between the second and the fifth floor?
I did. I talked to all of those, just about all of those people who were trapped in the North Tower. I talked to the people who were trapped in the South Tower. A man named Wilhelmino, whose friend Dominic Pizzullo died before his eyes in a course of 4 hours. I mean, he hung on and he hung on, and then finally he expired. Both of them were completely trapped and immobile. And so I went to Wilhelmino, and he told me that story. I went to the chief of department, who was Dan Nigro, and Dan Nigro took the place of Pete Gansey, who was the chief of department who had died in the second collapse. Dan Nigro had driven across the Brooklyn Bridge with Pete Gansey, and they talked, you know, Gansey was the chief of department and Nigro was the chief of operations. And of course, what they saw before them was the most extraordinary thing. I mean, in our experience, to see one floor of fire in a high-rise building is, you know, it is quite a job. To see two floors would be a major alarm, but here they were looking at 7, 8, and 10 stories on fire in the middle of the World Trade Center. So coming across the bridge, Dan Nigro just said to Chief Gansey, he said, Pete, this will be the worst day of our lives.
Let's talk a little bit about what faced the men at the top of the command who had to decide what the strategy should be for dealing with the towers as they burned before they collapsed. You interviewed surviving members of the command. Were there many men who had survived who were there from the beginning, or was it only people who came in later who you were able to talk to?
I talk about Joe Dunn, the first deputy police commissioner. And Joe Dunn was going to work. He got to the site just after the first plane went into the North Tower. And when he got there and got out of his car, he happened to be on crutches because he had snapped his Achilles tendon some weeks before. And he's a very big man, Joe Dunn, very well respected in the police department. I mean, maybe, you know, one of the most respected police officers in America. And he got out of his car on his crutches, and just then the second plane hit the South Tower. And when that second plane hit, it literally went through the building. And so so much came out the other side. I mean, planes, engines, part of the wings. And a huge amount of debris was thrown, showered, to the north side of the building. And Joe Dunn literally ran to get under building number 5, which had a sort of an overhang, which was just east of the North Tower. And while all of this murderous debris, went all around him. So he just saved himself there. At the very same time, part of an engine fell down into the courtyard between the two towers, went through the courtyard, and went into the bottom corridor of the World Trade Center, the one corridor that connects the two towers beneath the ground. And there it trapped John McLaughlin Wilhelmino and Dominic Pizzullo of the Port Authority Police Department. Now, few people know that, actually, that that collapse in that basement occurred with the crash of the second plane going into the South Tower. So all of these things were happening at once, and Joe Dunn then went to the command center of the Office of Emergency Management, which was in building number 7. Now, this is the building that, of course, collapsed at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And they couldn't get in there. They got into another building where the mayor was, and the police commissioner and fire commissioner had gone there. And then that group of people decided they were going to go to some other building to create a command center, and then they ended up in a firehouse up on Houston Street. Joe Dunn decided that he would go back with his men. And so he, with his crutches, went back to the fire scene, to the scene of the collapse. And the first building had collapsed, and he was down in the street, and his, you know, staff kept saying, "Hey, boss, we got to get out of here. You know, this building." He said, "No." He says, "I got to make sure all the men are out of here." And his car was parked down the street in front of the North Tower. And then finally a bomb squad truck passed by, and one of Joe's staff stopped the truck. They literally pushed him into this truck with his crutches, and the truck began to take off, and as it took off, the second tower came down. And had that truck not gone by at that moment, Joe probably would have said, "Okay, you're right, we got to get out of here," and they would have gone to their car, which was, the car was found 2 weeks later in the Staten Island dump. And it was completely incinerated and crushed. And they found Joe Dunn's sunglasses. And I tell this story. It's just an incidental story, but it gives an idea of the ruination there, that they found his sunglasses in the glove compartment of his car. And he was very finicky about his sunglasses, and they were expensive, and he was concerned about them. And when they found them, they sent them back to him in the metal case, completely burnt. And the sunglass lenses themselves had melted down into little BBs. And that's where Joe would have been, you know, in all probability. had that bomb squad truck not come by.
My guest is retired firefighter Dennis Smith, author of the new book Report from Ground Zero. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dennis Smith. He spent 18 years as a firefighter in New York. He's now Honorary Assistant Chief of the Fire Department. He's also the author of the bestseller Report from Engine Company 82. Now he's written a new book called Report from Ground Zero, in which he interviewed many of the people of the fire department from the command on down who were there on September 11th. Let me ask you a kind of general question about skyscrapers, and granted there's never been a catastrophe in a skyscraper like there was on September 11th, but when firemen get to a skyscraper fire, what are some of the things they have to keep in mind that make skyscraper fires different than any other kind of fire?
Well, the most fundamental consideration is how many floors of stairs do you have to walk up? Because you're carrying equipment, and that always is a challenge, just walking up the stairs. So that's the first consideration. The other is the water supply, and you have a standpipe system at the bottom of the building, which you feed into, and you put the water in the standpipe system. And your fundamental consideration at any fire, whether it's in high-rise or not, is the life issue, life safety. Who is trapped? Who is above the fire? How do you get them out? Have they been trained? Have they had fire drills? These are all the kinds of considerations that are made.
What about things like fear that the elevators might collapse and plummet to the ground, or a special kind of like air shafts and wind tunnels that might form?
Well, this was a great consideration in the World Trade Center. There were several people who were burned in the lobby of the North Tower, and they were burned because as they were walking into the lobby, a huge amount of burning aircraft fuel came down the elevator shaft and blew out into the lobby and burned a group of people pretty significantly. And the elevator shafts themselves can, in a fire, act as a flue. You're right in thinking about that. I guess, Terry, it'd be intelligent to explain to you the architecture of the building to help you understand that this building was built, if you think of a straw and then square the straw some way, and then that each floor was attached to the sides of the inside of this straw. And through the middle of the building itself was a shaft. And in this shaft were the elevators and the stairwells, the three emergency stairwells. And that gave the architect a huge amount of space to use, you know, usable or rentable or sellable space. And that is, of course, the mission of an architect is to try to build a building with as much, you know, economic usable space as possible. And in a building this size, normally you would get 50% of the floor space usable. And here, with the design that Yamasaki made when he designed this building, he got 75% usable space. And the 25% was used in the middle of the building with the elevators and the stairwells.
How did that affect how the fire spread?
It affected it greatly because when the plane came in, it went through this middle column of the elevators and stairwells. And so that immediately cut off the stairwells for any kind of escape, either down or up. I mean, these people couldn't get to the roof either because the fire was coming right up the stairway shafts now. And so that was a flaw in the design that they didn't recognize was flawed when they originally designed it, in my opinion. And And it also enabled, because there was no structural steel supporting this anywhere except for around this middle column, it allowed those floors to pancake so that when the first floor fell to the floor beneath it, the floor beneath it could not sustain the weight of one falling floor with the dynamic and, you know, weight of the fall. And then that, of course, led to a pyramid collapse, one after another after another.
What are you taught about when you're training to be a fireman, about when you go into a burning building and risk your life, and when it's just too risky and you don't, you know, you just don't go in knowing that you're going to be killed?
Well, I think that what you're taught initially is that you have to trust the experience of the person next to you, and your lieutenant or your captain. And if that person is bringing you into an environment that's, you know, by definition, is pretty hostile, if he's bringing you in there, your chances of being safe are pretty good, because his experience would, or his or her experience. Would have brought you there. And the reason I make that distinction is that the captain of one of the engine companies where several firefighters were lost is a woman and very well respected in the New York Fire Department. So you have to trust your leaders, because they're the only people who've been inside enough burning buildings to get a sense of what will happen. There are the academic understandings, but sometimes they don't serve you so well. For instance, the fact that steel stretches at 1,200 degrees inherent temperature is an academic understanding of the physics of fire, but it didn't help anybody knowing that in the World Trade Center, because of the way this plane came in, a plane that normally travels at 350 miles to 400 miles an hour comes in at 550 miles an hour. It is loaded with fuel. It has 24,000 gallons of fuel. It creates a comprehensive fire load on the floor. It heats the steel up comprehensively at every edge of the building, and when the steel buckles, the steel all stretches sort of simultaneously, and it creates this pancake effect when it finally collapses. No one ever thought that. There is no precedent for it, and now we know. We didn't know that before.
The firefighters were treated as heroes by all of New York and by all of the country as well. When you became a firefighter in the late 60s, you weren't always treated as a hero when you showed up to fight a fire. I mean, to the contrary, sometimes the firemen were treated as the bad guys. Where did you work, and what was the climate like there?
That was, I became a firefighter in 1963, and I worked in what was then the busiest company in the city of New York, Engine Company 82, which was in the South Bronx. And, you know, the world has changed so much since then. This was in the burn, baby, burn period of our history. There was extraordinary racial unrest in our inner cities. The politics of the nation was in turmoil because of the war in Vietnam and because of the advent of the civil rights movement and the manifestation of these things in our inner cities was pretty horrendous. I mean, we responded to 40 alarms a day, and we had two or three or four major fires every single day, and people were burning up their buildings because they felt that burning the buildings were better than living in them. And it was a political statement as well as anything. And when we got there, very often people would throw things at us and so on. But, you know, I don't feel any hostility toward those people, even looking back, because it was truly a part of the times, and firefighters suffered because of it. But yeah, it's a dangerous job anyway.
What kept you going then, fighting fires, when you were sometimes showing up at fires that were intentionally set by the people who lived there, and the people didn't want you to put it out, the people didn't like you or respect you necessarily when you showed up?
Well, you go to these scenes as a unit, as a company, with people that you know and respect and trust and that you've worked with. And so you do your job in accordance with the history of how these units work with each other and within the group. And so, you know, your obligation always is to go into that unit, no matter how many people are outside throwing stones at you, and the first thing you do is search for somebody who might be trapped above the fire or in the back room or whatever. And if that person is unconscious and or just recently expired, you know, you get on your knees and you give that person mouth-to-mouth resuscitation under any circumstances. And that's how we worked. And firefighters work pretty much the same way today. They are extraordinarily respected today in a new way because no one ever realized before the nature of going into a building that everyone was always running out of.
Well, Dennis Smith, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Dennis Smith is the author of Report from Ground Zero. He's a retired firefighter who's now an honorary assistant chief of department. Coming up, pop music critic Ken Tucker on the new CD of Love Songs for New York, recorded in response to September 11th. This is Fresh Air. In the months after the September 11th terrorist attacks, musicians have responded with numerous benefit concerts. Some are starting to record their reactions to the tragedy. One of them, country singer Alan Jackson, has a hit with his composition, Where Were You When the World Stopped Turning? Other reactions are captured on a new anthology assembled by the staff of the Village Voice on a CD called Wish You Were Here, Love Songs for New York. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. This is Ari Up, former member of the punk band The Slits.
Big up, New York!
Don't say nothing bad about New York.
Oh, no.
Don't say nothing bad about my city.
I love it so.
Don't say nothing bad about New York.
Oh, don't you know?
Don't say nothing bad about my city.
It's good.
It's good.
It's good to me.
Good to me.
Ari Up's reworked version of the Cookies' 1963 hit Don't Say Nothing Bad About My Baby is typical of the extremely varied music on Wish You Were Here, Love Songs for New York. It's full of impassioned, defiant, heartbreaking songs from a wide variety of artists, from aging folky Loudon Wainwright III to this song. It's called I Love New York City by Andrew W.K., a hot new up-and-comer you're going to hear a lot about in the coming months. I don't think you're necessarily going to hear Andrew W.K. on your favorite radio station anytime soon, but another singer and song that's inescapable right now is Alan Jackson's Where Were You When the World Stopped Turning, a country hit that has propelled its album to the top of the pop charts.
Where were you when the world stopped turning on that September day? Were you in the yard with your wife and children? Working on some stage in L.A. Did you stand there in shock at the sight of that black smoke rising against that blue sky? Did you shout out in anger and fear for your neighbor? Or did you just sit down and cry? Did you weep for the children?
The rebelliousness and anger that characterizes rock and roll is of lesser importance in country music, which prizes home and comfort as its ultimate solace. Which is to say that Where Were You, written by Jackson about the multitude of reactions prompted by the events of September 11th, wouldn't cut it as rock music, in whose context a line like, "Did you weep for the children who lost their dear loved ones?" might come off as mawkish. But when placed in a country music setting, it seems heartfelt, verging on eloquence. Some people think a tune like Where Were You, due in part to the very fact that it's a huge commercial success, exploits September 11th grief, manipulating melodrama. And I have to confess my own reservations about a line like, "I watch CNN, but I'm not sure I can tell you the difference between Iraq and Iran." My gut reaction is, well, heck, Alan, turn off the TV and read a history book on that tour bus once in a while, because distinctions like that have now become pretty dang essential. But when I hear Where Were You, it strikes me above all as an honest reaction, a direct communication between singer and audience, something that's rare in any kind of popular music. Everyone has his or her own reaction to September 11th. A wide variety, a tumultuous welter of voices, in fact, deserves to be heard.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Wish You Were Here, Love Songs for New York, is on Village Voice Records. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Hal, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Hannah's Gift, Lessons from a Life Fully Lived by Maria Husden, a memoir of life lessons taught to a mother by her daughter. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Looks like we made it.
On the next Fresh Air, Barry Manilow talks about his hits and his career before the hits, when he was writing advertising jingles and working as Bette Midler's music director. He has a new greatest hits collection and a CD of new songs. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.